You're listening to the Unsiloed Podcast with Greg LeBlanc, brought to you by alumni.fm. Unsiloed is a series of interdisciplinary conversations that inspire new ways of thinking about our world. So wherever you are today, enjoy today's episode, and here's your host, Greg LeBlanc.
Welcome to Unsiloed. This is Greg LeBlanc, and I'm here today with Eilat Fischbach, who is a professor at University of Chicago, Graduate School of Business, the Booth School, and also the author of this book right here, Get It Done, Surprising Lessons from the Science of Motivation. Now, I guess I should have said the young science of motivation because it is a relatively young science. And I suppose we could say it started out with behavioralism, but we've come such a long way. And in this book, you describe a number of pieces of that science. In particular, you talk about goal selection, goal achievement, goal juggling, and so forth. But what I find really interesting about the book is that you emphasize how people, in many ways, we kind of manipulate ourselves, right? So, you know, in behavioral economics, we talk about how people are prone to all of these fallacies and biases and make all these mistakes. But we sometimes forget that people are aware of them. They're aware of their own quirks, and they sometimes kind of leverage these quirks. And in your book, you really are very explicit about how you can cultivate the landscape of motivation that you have within to better achieve your goals. That's the aspect of the book I found really fascinating. So welcome, Eilat.
Thanks for having me, Greg. And thanks for already talking about the doer and the planner and how they interact. And you're already full in. I'm curious to know where our conversation is going to take us from here.
I remember an example of this from my colleagues where they studied folks who went to the gym and, you know, they seemed to overpay for their gym membership, if you look at it based on how many times they would go to the gym. And half the people, when they look at that, they say, oh yeah, these people are stupid. They're paying $20 a visit when they could just pay $10 a visit. And then the other half of the people say, no, this is actually quite clever because what they're doing is they're converting the marginal cost of going to the gym to zero and thereby giving themselves a little extra boost. And I always wonder, why do some people systematically fall on one side of that debate and others seem to fall on the other? You sort of understand both of those positions, and I don't think you have a dog in that fight. I think some people are aware of these things and some people aren't.
A few things here. I don't think that awareness is often a critical variable here. The question should be whether people are doing something that is adaptive for them, that serves their goals. And I think that as a field, we are probably too quickly to say that there is a mistake. We like to highlight people's mistakes. And often what we refer to as a mistake is quite adaptive. When people set deadlines that are unrealistic, well, it could be a mistake, it could be a planning fallacy, it could also be a way to motivate yourself. And often we are, as a field, as academics, too quick to call it a fallacy or a bias and kind of neglect the fact that the early deadline was a motivational tool, that the pre-commitment meant to motivate someone to go to the gym. And maybe it has failed, okay? Maybe the person discovers by the end of the year that they only went three times and that meant that they paid hundreds of dollars for each time that they went for the gym. But maybe the reason that they go to the gym is that they are more stingy than lazy, in which case this strategy works.
I think the way you start the book is you say that sometimes the probability of achieving a goal is affected at the outset based on how you define the goal or how you think about the goal. And that when people the classic case is at the very beginning of the year, when people are making their New Year's resolutions, if your New Year's resolution is too vague, then you're probably going to get less far down the goal than if you have very precise objectives. When I was reading about a lot of this, sometimes you describe this in terms of individuals and their goal achievement. But because I teach management, I'm always thinking, yeah, but this is also true for when employers are trying to get employees to do things. And also when parents are trying to get kids to do something. Tell us a bit more about goal formulation and how important is it that you set the goals initially from the very beginning in a way that increases the likelihood of you getting there?
So let me first say that I wrote the book thinking about how people can use the science of motivation to motivate themselves, but admittedly, most of the science is on how to motivate others. Okay, so most of the science is on managers motivating employees, educators motivating students, parents motivating their children. It's often where we go. Now, it's not everything. We do have research on self-control, which is how people motivate themselves. So there is this part, but it's not where we went as science, as a field over the last 20 years. Saying that, there is no reason that people cannot apply these lessons to themselves, in the sense that we can operate on ourselves the same way that we operate on someone else. Okay? If I want my 10-year-old to wake up in the morning, I open the curtain and he's not going to sleep in a sunny room. Okay? It's easier to sleep in a dark room. Okay? If I want to wake up in the morning by myself, then I set an alarm clock, because it's harder to sleep in a noisy room than a quiet room. It's a trivial example, but I'm basically using the same principle to motivate someone else as I used to motivate myself. And now you're asking about how to best set a goal. And again, I would say it's the same for setting a goal for others and for yourself. And there are a few principles. We want the goal to be enticing, to be something that we aspire to achieve, that seems more like a goal and less like a chore. The problem with New Year's resolution is that we often plan to be a different person that is going to do what's important for her and not what she finds pleasurable, not what she's excited about. But the person we are is pursuing goals that are exciting and less goals that seem like a chore, that are not exciting. And so the goal should be exciting. It should have ideally some specific target, okay, so some numbers that defines how much and how soon. In general approach, do goals are better than do not goals. Avoidance goals are good in the sense that they seem urgent. Approach goals are good in the long run, okay? The goals that we can persist on. Intrinsic motivation is a big thing, okay? So we're feeling motivated by doing and not necessarily only by achieving. Now, we set a goal because we want to achieve it, not because it is pleasant to pursue. We set a goal to finish an MBA degree and not to eat more ice cream. But the extent to which we're enthusiastic at the moment that it feels good, that predicts adherence much more than how important is the goal in the long run. And so I'm touching just several principles in goal setting, and I didn't even get to incentives.
I think of motivation as overlapping with willpower, or what people used to call self-control. Ancient Greeks would spend a lot of time talking about this. Later in the book, you talk about self-control, but are these different mechanisms when we think about approach and avoidance? Isn't it the same force that we're dipping into when we're thinking about powering through to achieve something when you don't really want to, or forcing yourself not to do something when you really want to? How are they the same and how are they different?
So they are the same in the sense that you just described. Okay, willpower is the power that you use to motivate yourself, to get yourself to do something. But they are different in the sense that we often think about willpower in the literature as well as in lay language is self-control, okay, is overcoming yourself, is doing something that's hard to do, that you don't want to do, but that you can somehow get yourself to do. Okay, self-control is required when you have goal conflict, when there is a goal that you want to pursue, but there is something else that stands in the way that you really want to do. You think that you should eat one thing, but you want to eat the other thing. You think that you should control your temper, but you are tempted to just express how you feel. These situations exist. They are not the entire field of motivation, and often the situations that we are aware of because we are already failing, because it's already hard. In a way, we think about willpower when we are already struggling, when we already have something that goes against us, whereas many of the goals that we set are just intrinsically motivating, and are just set such that we are excited about doing them. If we plan everything right, then we will be less aware of willpower, and it will be more like something that we do either because it's a habit or because it's exciting, it's fun, it's part of my purpose, what I want to achieve as a person.
So, I mean, I'm thinking in terms of so many people are swimming in a sea of distractions and stimuli, right? So whether it's the stream of news or games or whatever that's available on your phone, or whether it's the things that are available on television, or just particularly in this world, in the world of constant media that's available at the faucet, so to speak, that especially young people, they seem to just let hours and hours go by, and they don't seem to be in pursuit of goals. They just seem to be in pursuit of getting through the next 30 seconds with some stimulus. And so in that case, if someone knew that they were trapped in a sort of addictive spiral like that, would it be better for them to psychologically focus on, hey, I got to stop doing this, I got to lock up the phone, or I need to find some pursuit that is so attractive to me that I don't even notice, or I'm not even aware of the temptations?
Yeah, I would say that the latter. So there are many things that we try to avoid in our daily life, and social media is definitely a big one. Okay? How do I get it off my phone and focus on what's important for me, what's more valuable? The problem is if you set your goal as avoiding, okay, as don't look at your phone, don't think about something, don't drink something, don't eat something, that mere goal brings to mind the thing that you should not do. Okay, when I set my goal as not going on social media, the way for me to know that I am successful is by asking, where are you on social media? And by that, bringing this to mind. Okay? And so it's kind of hard to pursue these goals where the way to check yourself is by reminding yourself of the thing that you're trying not to do. The other problem with avoidance goals, with don't do goals, is that they elicit reactions. Okay? We are often rebels. Okay? We want to do something just because we are not allowed to do that, even if we are the people who said that you are not allowed to do that. Some people have this feeling when you decide to go on a diet and immediately you are so tempted by all the things that you resolve not to eat. Okay, you're rebelling against yourself. By the way, you can use this for good. I'm being reminded of Chris Bryan's research that used reactants to get teenagers to reject junk food. And what he did in his studies was telling teenagers that marketers want them to eat junk food. Okay? Mm-hmm. And there was all like these marketing campaigns trying to get you to eat the food that's unhealthy for you, and then get the reactants response. But now, going back to your question, the problem with avoidance goals is that they make us rebels. They bring to mind the thing that you should not do. And they're just not fun to pursue. So find another hobbies is better than stop obsessing on your current hobby.
But you also talk about kind of hands tying a little bit later in the book, where it seems like there are certain people that know how to, I don't know, constrain their choice going forward so that the range of choices include only the things that are in pursuit of the goal. So for instance, with the phone, it would be putting the phone on silent mode, or putting the phone somewhere that's harder to reach, or doing something that would reflect some awareness of the fact that a lot of the activity is unchosen. How do people become better at that? Is that something that people become educated about, or how do people learn to control themselves in that way? I think one of the examples you used is someone who, you notice that some people will push the wine glass away from themselves and pull the water glass towards themselves, which is a subtle way of leveraging the fact that people reach unthinkingly for the thing that's closer to them.
Yes, and you can describe all of these strategies as basically making that goal more likely and the temptation less likely. Okay, and so you can buy more of the food that you want to eat and little of the food that you don't want to eat. So you increase the presence of one and reduce the presence of others. You can pre-commit, and you started with an example of pre-commitment to avoiding temptation by putting the phone away, okay? Or in my book, I give the example of deleting the phone number of someone that you don't want to be in touch with. By an economics analysis, just having the number there doesn't mean that you need to contact the person. It's an added option that you don't have to use. And presumably having options should not be a problem because you can always choose not to use these options. But by a psychological analysis, we know that there are certain people that we might be tempted to get in touch and they are unhealthy for us. I give the example of trying to end a relationship that is unhealthy for the person. And so you will delete the previous partner's contact information so that this is no longer an option. This is pre-commitment to avoid someone. We also see in studies that people are getting closer to those that help them achieve their goals. Okay? So students are very strategic in choosing friends that will help them do well in school. Good students are popular because these are the people that will help you in your life. And moving away from some people and approaching other people, moving away from some foods and approaching other foods are all self-control strategies that are meant to take a goal and temptation that have a similar appeal and make the temptation significantly less appealing or less available than the goal. How much people are aware of it? We find that they don't really need to be aware of it in order to do it. Okay? And so somehow in their development, people learn to do that. By the way, also animals sometimes display similar behaviors. So it doesn't seem like you really need high level cognition in order to display some self-control, okay, some application of these strategies. But we hope that as people develop, as they learn, they can better plan. They are better able to do that. Let me also add something about habits. That we know that habits work well, okay? You know that once you made something into a habit, then often it's going to happen by itself. But then many behaviors are never completely habitual, okay? And so while brushing your teeth is probably completely habitual, you don't need any willpower in order to get yourself to do that in the morning. Going to the gym, even if you are going on most mornings and you've been doing it for many years, is something that's much easier to drop, okay? And that in a way, if you don't constantly reinforce the habit, it can disappear from your life more easily than brushing your teeth, for example. And so you get these behaviors where they constantly need to be supported. You constantly need to do something to motivate yourself to follow through.
You didn't use the term, but I think of them as self-nudging. You're using the nudge principle on yourself to some extent by making the path of least resistance the thing that you most want to achieve. But you also talk about, and again, I don't think you used the term self-signaling, and this idea that if you're doing something, well, you know, you must like it. And sometimes the best way to get the ball rolling is just to start. You talk about some interesting research about how people don't necessarily know what they like. And so they can be manipulated into liking certain things the way Tom Sawyer did. But they can also manipulate themselves into liking things and kind of Tom Sawyering themselves, right?
Yes. And we can think about self-nudging. I didn't use this expression, but I kind of like it. We do nudge ourselves. And we know from basically research that goes all the way to the beginning of social psychology as a field that people become to like what they do. Okay? That the processes such as dissonance and self-perception lead us to appreciate the things that we invested in. And so often way to get yourself to do something is by first doing it and then learning to like it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the idea is that when you do something, you ask yourself, why am I doing it? Okay. Like, why am I working so hard to get this graduate degree or to launch this successful product at work? And you become more committed by the fact that you look back and see yourself doing that. And this is another nice example of behaviors that we would consider maybe fallacies, maybe healthy motivational tools. And this is the sunk cost effect, right? So sunk cost is considered a bias. You're not supposed to be working on something just because you invested in the past. You should look at what you expect to get from doing the activity, from pursuing the goal, and this is all that matters. Okay? You should not be in a relationship just because you've been in this relationship for many years. Okay? You should think about how do you value having this relationship moving forward, for example. But sunk cost results from a very effective motivational tool, which is that as we do something, we develop our commitment, which allows us to stick to some goal for a long time, which allows us to keep doing our work when we don't see immediate rewards, keep working on a paper that's really hard to publish or that the studies take forever to run. And you stay committed because you think, well, I've already invested in this for 2 years, I might as well continue for a third year. And this is a motivational tool. This is learning from your commitment. You mentioned self-signaling. Self-signaling is often a motivational tool that refers to doing something because I want to be the kind of person that pursue this goal, okay? And so the reason to pursue goals is often because there are certain rewards associated with it. Okay, I might want to get a job as a professor because I want to be employed, and I think that this is an amazing job to have. It's a wonderful lifestyle. Self-signaling is the other motivation, which comes from how that reflects on the self. Maybe it's not about the rewards. It's about how I'm going to see myself, okay? So I want to do it because it reflects well on me as a person. I want to think of myself as someone who's going to be a professor or an academic. And there are some studies that separate between these motivations. One nice example is you manipulate whether people think that they will remember their action, okay? If you think that you're going to have a good memory of what you did, then you're more likely to do it if you are thinking about the self-signaling, okay? If you think about how that reflects on who you are as a person. But whether you will remember your action or not really doesn't matter for the rewards that you're going to get from this action. So maybe this is a bit abstract. Let me give you an example. Whether you would choose the healthy snack over the unhealthy snack, if you are more likely to choose the healthy snack over the unhealthy snack when you expect to remember your action, for example, when it's like your first choice in the day, okay, as opposed to some choice in the middle, then we would conclude that you are mostly driven by self-signaling. Okay, you want to think of yourself as a health-conscious individual because eating healthy food will have the same impact on your body regardless of whether it's in the morning or at noon.
Now, I always wonder with these healthy snacks, you always use chocolate as the unhealthy. And I'm always a little concerned about this because I always thought that chocolate was healthy. You guys must be using some terrible chocolate as an unhealthy option. But in terms of sunk cost fallacy, I use this all the time. I'll sign up for subscriptions, for instance, to the opera or to the symphony or to the theater, because on any given Friday night, after a long day of work, I'm not particularly thrilled to go out. But because I spent that money on those tickets, I'm going to go. And so it's totally irrational for me to do it simply because I spent the money. But I know that I behave that way. And so I leverage that to become the person that I want to be or to do what I think is in my best interest in the long run. People do this all the time.
Okay. First about chocolate. Okay. We not only we don't decide what people think is healthy or unhealthy, we often disagree. Like I have a study in which people were choosing whether to eat raisins or some chocolate, and the participants in our study thought that raisins are healthy, okay, that this is fruit and chocolate is unhealthy. I personally don't think that there is anything in particular healthy about raisins. So I'm just interested in how people resolve self-control conflicts, how they choose their food. We have now a lot of work in how people think about healthy food, and we often disagree. Like, people think about healthy food as unprepared. Okay? It's the food that is served without spices. I don't think that there is anything that makes food healthier when you remove the spices, but I study how people think about food and how they make their choices. And then you are describing the tendency to highbrow activities and purchases long-term in advance, which is interesting, how we need to pre-commit ourselves to have an experience that we know that we will value, but we might not want to initiate in the moment. And your example about pre-committing to going to the theater is wonderful. It shows how much it's often easier to exercise self-control in advance. Okay, in my research, I refer to this as counteractive self-control. You counteract temptation before it's actually there. Okay, you decide to go to the theater before it's actually a Tuesday at 6 p.m. and you are tired and you just want to watch TV. This is one example. Other example is that when we just remind people that there will be temptations, that the situation is going to be tense, then they are less likely to lose their temper, that there will be a lot of alcohol in the party, they are less likely to drink too much. If you know that there is going to be a problem, it's like if you know that the box is going to be heavy and you're going to lift it, your body is preparing to physically lift it, your mind metaphorically does the same. Okay? If we know that something is going to be hard, we can better handle this in advance than when it's hard without a warning.
I love that example that you made about how people tend to think that food is healthier if it's bland and unpleasant. And as somebody who cooks a lot, I find this makes no sense at all empirically. But I think it taps into what you talk about as sort of the dilution principle or over-justification effect. And I found this fascinating because in the world of marketing, you think, oh, if I just add more and more features, and I say, not only is it a floor cleaner, but it's also a mouthwash, then you'd expect to sell more. But the implications of your research is that, no, actually, you're going to sell less because people don't want something that works for everything. If I say, I've got a moisturizer that works on your eyelids and your turkey neck, then you think, well, it can't be very good at either one, right? So first of all, I'm interested in the categories, where these categories come from, but why is it that we do that? Is it, in economics terms, it's almost as if everyone thinks that we're on the Pareto frontier all the time and that there's no win-win available. And indeed, if everything already was on the Pareto frontier, then the only way to get more in one dimension is to give up in the other dimension. But we spend so much of our lives inside the frontier that when someone comes along and says, hey, it's faster and cheaper and better, sometimes it's true, but people are suspicious.
I'm still stuck on your example of a mouthwash that you can use to clean the floor. I am pretty sure that this is going to be a terrible marketing idea.
It's from an old Saturday Night Live skit in the 1970s. I remember some fake ad that they had on TV.
Yes, we know that this is not going to work, and this is exactly because of the dilution principle, that if a means and not an object, a product, an activity serves two goals, then you assume it is less instrumental for each of these goals. The psychology underlying it is pretty simple. It is less likely to bring to mind that goal. Okay, so the delicious, healthy food that you have made is less likely to bring to mind healthy food, okay, or the health category, and maybe also less likely to bring to mind the delicious category, okay, delicious food. And therefore, it might seem less instrumental to each of them. Now, of course, this is a mistake in the sense that this is an inference that you make based on the strengths of association between the means here and the goal. But in theory, a means can serve two goals. There is no reason to think that if a food is healthy, it's not tasty, or if a food is tasty, it's unhealthy. When it gets to products design, it's often something that companies are giving a lot of thought of. Like, how can you keep it in the same category? Can, how can you expand the category without diluting your identity? And there are many successful examples. The smartphone has a bunch of categories in it that we have now as a society, as people, categorized under a smartphone. And so the same thing that I use to make calls, I also use as my calendar, and it seems as one function. But, you know, it takes some education, it takes time, it takes like realizing what new categories can be created at any given time. There are many goals that we see as conflicting, or at least as, you know, incongruent to some extent, like mentioned health and taste. We also see something that is like pleasurable versus important, that people say, if it's important, then I might not enjoy it as much. And like, you see these conflicts. As I talk about it, I'm being reminded of the old advertisement for cough medicine that went something like, it's awful and it works. Okay, like it tastes awful and it works. And the idea was that we know that people think that medicine that's bitter is more effective. Mm-hmm. And people also think that this is newer data, that mouthwash that stings is better. Okay. And so these are like counter final activities. Okay? So multi-final activities are activities that serve several goals at the same time. It's like in my book, I refer to this as feeding two birds with one scone, because I don't like killing birds. And they are presumably the activities that we should look for. Okay, maybe we should walk to the gym instead of driving to the gym, so that we get our exercising and our way there in the same activity. But people often behave as if they want to separate. And the reason is that they believe that an activity is less instrumental for one goal if it's instrumental for the other goal.
Like kosher ice cream.
Yeah, the question is, I use the example of driving to the gym and like trying to find a parking spot that is the closest to the door, which we often do. And it's like, now when we think about it, it doesn't make sense, because obviously I'm a person that wants to exercise. Why do I park very close to the entrance to the gym? The kosher ice cream is another one, and this is Itamar Simonson's study from the 90s, reminding people that an ice cream is kosher made them think that it doesn't taste very good. It decreased their interest to the extent that they didn't care for kosher. No, just adding that goal made people conclude that this ice cream is probably not so great in terms of taste. Okay, the other goal is being compromised.
But doesn't that pose a bit of a puzzle, right? So suppose I want to be someone who is fit. So I want to exercise a lot. Now, I know that if I pick a fun exercise, I'm more likely to do it. But if I pick an unfun exercise, then I'll maybe be able to convince myself that I am more diligent in pursuit of my goal. Is there any downside to picking the fun exercise? Will my motivation be undermined in some way because I'll doubt that I'm actually pursuing the goal of fitness?
Yeah, this is great. So there are a couple of advantages for the unfun exercise. One is that it seems more instrumental. Okay, if you hate it, you assume that it's really great for your body. And the other one is that we talked about self-signaling. It's a great signal that you care about exercising. We know that runners see themselves as tour runners when they run in Chicago in a cold winter day, okay? Not when they are running in Berkeley on a nice spring day. But, and this is a big but, what predicts adherence to exercising is intrinsic motivation, which is really how much people enjoy that at the moment. And so despite the fact that doing something that doesn't feel comfortable might make you feel that this was very important for you and a great exercise, you're actually less likely to come back again and then to do it maybe 4 times a week. And so overall, I would say that's not a great strategy. Finding an exercise that you enjoy doing, or not even increasing variety, okay, what you enjoy doing yesterday might be boring today, is really the way to get people to stick with the exercising goal.
Now, I think one of the more interesting parts of your book is your contribution to the millennium-old debate about kind of half full versus half empty. This has been a debate, not whether it is half full or half empty, but how you should look at things. Should you focus on what has been accomplished to date, or should you focus on the distance ahead of you to achieve the goal? And I think this ties in many ways to the idea that proximity to the goal is going to be in proximity to the starting point. These things influence your motivation. And you talk a bit about the deadly middle, or there's sort of some spot where your motivation is probably kind of lowest. Could you talk a bit about, this seems like there's an entire field of motivation research. You could spend your entire lifetime just focusing on this one domain within motivation science.
So there are a few things here. First, that with progress, motivation increases. Okay, so now in general, we see that the more people do, the more motivated they are. Okay, most people who drop out college do it in the first or second year, not when they're about to finish. Most consumers who are enrolled in a loyalty program drop the loyalty program after making one purchase, not when they are one purchase away from reward. And there is a good reason. You get more for your effort the more progress you have made. Okay? Your last year in college is getting you a full college degree. Your first year in college is getting you 25% of a college degree, of a four-year college degree. And so there is just more that you get for your effort, the more progress you have made, if it's an all or nothing.
If it's a discontinuous reward structure, then that's certainly true, right?
Yeah. Yes. Now, we also see that with progress, there is often more motivation for open-ended goals. And we discussed it before, your first exercise might feel difficult. It's a new exercise, but then after you did it a few times, you learn to like it. You look at yourself and you say, I guess I'm a committed swimmer. I'm going to continue swimming in my local swimming pool and so on. But we also see that often when people make progress, they use it as a license to disengage, okay? They feel like they've done enough, mm-hmm. okay? And so when I look back and I say, well, I've been working so hard today or this week, maybe I should take some time off. Maybe when I consider the times that I already exercised, I feel like that I've exercised enough. I don't need to do it today. And then the glass half empty becomes more motivating, okay? And then it's looking at the times that I haven't exercised or the things that I didn't do at work that's more motivating. And now we are getting to the interesting question of how should you monitor your progress? Should you look back and say, oh, I've done that much, or look ahead and say, here's everything that I can still do? And to make things really simple and probably oversimplified, if you are new to something, if you are not committed, then it's better to look back and say, oh, I've already done some. If you are already committed, definitely if you are beyond the 50%, if it's an all or nothing goal, then it's better to look ahead at what you still need to do. Okay, and the idea is that looking back makes you more committed. And if that was the issue, if you didn't know whether you're truly committed to this thing, then look back, think about what you have done, that will increase your commitment. If you're already committed, now you're more sensitive to how much progress you're making, and highlighting that you're farther from your goal, like that makes you want to make this extra progress. Either way, there is a problem in the middle, okay? Because at the beginning, there is that the enthusiasm of the beginning, and like any progress will feel relatively fast. Okay, I was at 0% and I am already at 5% or 10%. Toward the end, again, like you are almost there. And again, this is to the extent that the goal has an end, okay, that it's all or nothing goal. Then, you know, it's my last in college, okay, the last purchase before I get the reward. people are excited about finishing their goals. And in the middle, this is when we see a problem. And we see it when we look at physical performance, when we look at like runners or swimmers, they slowing down in the middle. When we look at students, the middle of the quarter is usually when they are more likely to skip class or skip their homework. And even for our own ongoing goals, like the middle of the week, the middle of the days.
The hump day.
Yeah. And so the solution is probably to keep middles short.
So you talk about cutting corners and how people tend to be less ethical in the middle. And maybe they're thinking that whoever's observing their work isn't going to notice because it's buried in the middle. Maybe they themselves think that they're not going to notice because it's buried in the middle. So when you say make the middles short, does that mean to subdivide the progress bar, so to speak, to provide intermediate, almost artificial completions along the way so that you can say, yeah, okay, I've completed. And I think in terms of in American football, when you go 10 yards, you get a new set of downs. So it's, oh, I've got a fresh start. Like I'm done. Or there's first, second, third down, and now it's first down again. So by slicing the field up into these 10-yard increments, you're almost making those middles much, much shorter than they would be otherwise, right?
Yes, you nicely illustrated another two problems with middles. Not only we are doing less, okay, we are also cutting corners. Okay, that is, we are doing things less in the right way. Okay, we are less ethical, and we are less ethical and less likely to adhere to our performance standard, both because we think that other people will not notice and we think that we will not remember. Right? Like if I don't remember what I do in the middle, then I don't need to pay attention.
You mentioned on vacations, people remember the first day and the last day more than they remember middle day.
Yes, and so you need like your first and last day to do something special, right? In the middle, if you don't think that you will remember, then you don't care so much. We did one study with Rima Tuatillery where we gave people a piece of paper with shapes on it and mm-hmm. a pair of scissors to cut these shapes, and they were literally cutting corners in the middle. Okay. But you know, when you talk about the solution of cutting the goal to sub-goals, I think that, yeah, we all do it all the time. Take savings for retirement. It's a really long-term goal. Okay, but we often think about how much we save this year. Okay, so we make dozens of years goal into maybe a one-year sub-goal, which is probably still too long. It's probably better to think about savings in terms of a monthly goal. Exercising. We are encouraged to monitor how much we exercise per day. Okay, so we have a daily goal. Like, what does it mean? And of course, like tomorrow will be another daily goal. And every day I want to exercise, but I don't think about how much I work out this year or this decade. I think about how much I work out today, which is a sub goal that has no middle.
But you also talk about the what the hell effect, right? Which is you miss a goal. If you have a all or nothing goal, then missing it by a little and missing it by a lot shouldn't make a whole heck of a lot of difference. So if you really say, I need to do this, I need to lose 10 pounds, I'm not going to be happy with 9 pounds, I'm not going to be happy with 9.9 pounds, I got to lose 10 pounds, then as soon as you realize it's not going to happen, then why not miss by 10 pounds? How do you then all of a sudden switch back to convincing yourself that 9.9 is better than 7 when you had spent all this time trying to convince yourself that you needed to make it to 10? If you could switch back and forth between those two perspectives, then it would make the all or nothing way of thinking more difficult to sustain, no?
Yeah, and you highlight one of the problems with goals, okay? So we set goals that are ambitious. We set goals that we don't know if we can reach this specific target, okay? We don't know if we can do like this much by that time. And we did that on purpose, okay? The challenging target is better than the target that we know we can achieve for sure. But the problem is that once we fail on that target, then we might give up. Okay, we might say whatever, like what the hell, okay, the day is ruined, or maybe that the goal is ruined. There is a nice study that looks at the distribution of marathon times in the US. It's like almost 10 million marathon time. Devin Pop and George Wu, who are my colleagues here at the University of Chicago, were on that paper with more authors. And if you look at the distribution of marathon times, there are many more people in the U.S. that finish a marathon just below 4 hours than just above 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the distribution is not smooth. Now, it's a nice demonstration of the motivating effect of goal setting, because many marathon runners want to achieve their goal under 4 hours, okay, finish the marathon under 4 hours. There are many people there. But it's interesting to note that when you see that there are very few people that are finishing the marathon just over 4 hours, it's possible that at least some of them, once they realize that they are not doing it under 4 hours, they gave up. And now they are taking some extra time, okay? And now they are not finishing in 4 hours and 2 minutes, because if I cannot finish it under 4 hours, I might as well finish it in 4 hours and 20 or 30 minutes. We see this with food all the time, that if people just miss it by a little, they completely go off track and just eat whatever is in the fridge. We see that with exercising, people that have a step count, they would really care about getting to the 10,000 steps a day. So if they're just 100 steps below that, they will walk around their bedroom trying to get the last 100 steps. But if the day is ruined, if let's say I did like a flight that day, which means that my step count is going to be pretty low, then they don't even bother, okay? That if I can't get to 10,000, I might as well just sit in my chair for the entire day, which is the downside of goal setting, that when you give up, you might be really giving up.
You see the same thing with corporate earnings, right? So when you beat earnings announcement, you beat them by a penny. When you beat forecasted earnings, but when you miss it, you know, you can miss it by a lot. So the last thing I want to ask you about is emotions. And you talk about how important emotions are. And of course, emotions can be created by the judgment of others, right? So as managers, we think a lot about, do you want to motivate your employees with fear or love? But the same applies when you're trying to motivate yourself, right? So if you make yourself feel really bad, okay, that's going to have a certain impact. And if you make yourself feel really good, and the area where I think you dig deep into this is how negative feedback affects people and how it can either be a motivator or a demotivator, depending in part on the emotional impact that it has. If we're trying to motivate ourselves, how can we leverage our emotions? Is it okay to make yourself feel bad for failing to perform? Is there a good way to do that? How do you use positive and negative feedback on yourself to inspire motivation?
So emotions, in motivation science, we often think about emotions as feedback system. And I often find it confusing, because emotions can be the goal in its own. Okay, like many people say, like, that my goal is to like feel happy. But I believe that it's more accurate to think about happiness, pride, or satisfaction, or anxiety, or fear, or depression as feedback to how are you doing in your life, and how should you change what you're doing or keep it up. And the extent to which you have emotions such as regret or pride, that usually directly about how well you are doing on your goals. Okay, like regret means that you didn't do something that you thought you should have done. Okay, so that's a cue to engage in this behavior. Pride is the signal, the internal signal, that you're doing well on your self-control goal. Okay, so you did something that was more important, that you prioritized over another goal. So both are informative, but what we find in general is that people are struggling to learn from negative feedback, and specifically from negative emotions. Several reasons for that. When it gets to negative emotions, often what you do is take care of the emotion and not the goal.
Okay? Deflect it, right?
Yeah. Okay. That means if I'm trying not to feel bad, I might not pursue the goal. I might just find a shortcut.
Or you might cover up the signal which leading to the negative emotion. So if you're dealing with the work situation, if you see an email where you think that someone's going to be giving you a hard time for your work, you just don't open it.
Yes. Okay. So you can ignore it in the first place, right? You can ignore negative feedback by knowing that it's coming and never opening the email. You can also find shortcuts to improve your mood, right? With substance abuse. There are ways in which you can improve our mood that don't actually address the goal. There are also like two specific barriers to learning from negative feedback. One is that it hurts, and the other one is that it's often hard just cognitively to learn from negative feedback. The hurting part is easy to understand, okay? When we fail or when we get negative feedback, it stings, okay? It's one reason, by the way, why we sometimes learn more from others' failures than from our own. When I observe that you are messing up, it's easy for me to learn. When I mess up, I might disengage. But also cognitively learning from failure is often hard because it requires learning what not to do. It's learning by elimination. And this extra cognitive step, if that's not the right way, then I should look at the other way, is often a huge barrier. Okay, we did studies in which we asked people, in a world in which there are three options, okay, there's the big success, small success, and small failure, what do you want to know? Okay, do you want to experience like that? No, the small success or the small failure? So presumably we cannot tell you where the big success is. If you're not one of the other two, then you can kind of by elimination figure out where to go. And what we find is that many people say that they want to learn about the small success, whereas the correct answer is that you want to know about the small failure. Okay, if you know about where the small failure is, now you have a better chance at getting the big success because you will now be randomly choosing between small success and a large success. But people don't quite take this extra step. Okay, they don't think about the information that was in the failure, and so they don't explore it. They don't want to get this information. We also find that people don't share information on failure with other people, and probably because it's not something that the people are proud of. They don't want to broadcast the things that didn't work well. But what it means is that there is just less information that we can learn from. Okay, there is just less in the market of ideas, okay, and the wisdom of the crowd. There is less information on learning from failure because people don't talk about it.
So, here in Silicon Valley, venture capitalists are always evaluating founders and ideas. And I think when I ask them, what are they looking for? It seems like in many cases, what they're really looking for is a founder that has the right kind of motivation. And when you dig deep into that, say, what exactly are you looking for? They say, I want someone who is going to essentially walk through walls and is willing to light themselves on fire in order to achieve a goal. And you say, oh, so you want someone who's stubborn and someone who is going to ignore bad feedback and ignore the pitfalls on the way. And they say, no, actually, we want them to be flexible and be willing to pivot all the time. And so when you're trying to figure, well, how can you have somebody who wants to walk through walls to achieve a goal, but is also willing to abandon goals and pivot all the time? I think it lines up in many ways with what you're describing, which is really the ability to understand how to define and understand goal formation in a way that facilitates flexibility on the way to the achievement of those goals.
Yes, and I like this story because you really want the person that is learning from their setbacks, that expects many setbacks. And so we know that either in Silicon Valley in developing technology or in science, you have a lot of setbacks. Most of your ideas, or at least most of the ways in which you test your ideas, are going to lead to nowhere. And the question is whether the person is learning from that. Now, learning from that, the fear is that what you learn is that you cannot, okay, that will never work. So learn helplessness is also learning. Okay, learn helplessness is when you learn that you cannot do this, okay? That because I gave you a negative feedback on whatever. You took my class in social psychology and you got negative feedback. You learned that you can never be a social psychologist. this is learning, but the wrong kind of learning. Okay? This is an overgeneralized belief that you cannot do something. This is something that Martin Seligman showed many years ago, led dogs not to avoid electric shocks because they had the bad experience of being in an environment in which you couldn't control electric shocks. Between like that overgeneralized learning and not learning anything, okay, which is just ignoring failures and not doing that, like the elimination process that I just described, that I just learned about one way in which that doesn't work. You get a healthy learning, which is there is still a lot to explore. There is still a lot to do here. I just discovered what doesn't work, and I'm going to try the next thing that might work or not. And you know, the people that that you talk to in Silicon Valley, if they know what they are looking for, then hopefully it's that person.
Aylett, thank you so much for joining me. The book here is Get It Done: Surprising Lessons from the Science of Motivation. It really walks through quite a wide range of interesting insights and studies. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to the Unsiloed podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review. To listen to other episodes, please visit our website at www.unsiloedpodcast.com.